So I actually don't have a PowerPoint. I'm just going naked here. But the AV guy told me we had to have this slide up for the recording to work. So high technology, I guess. Anyway, thanks for having me. It's really a pleasure for me to take part in this panel. I guess I am often the only lawyer on a panel, so that's okay. But it's really great to be with scientists, researchers that are so willing to speak out, and I just really think we should acknowledge that, because too often researchers are intimidated or just don't have the right personalities, or for whatever reason, obviously concerned about their careers, don't have the kind of bravery that we're seeing here. So thank you all for that. Yes. And I was amused because I think you all actually mentioned lawyers in probably a not very nice way. So that's okay.
We need you.
Yes. Well, thank you, because that is why I'm here, to help you guys as much as I can. And I'm actually the kind of lawyer that doesn't sue people, although I'm not adverse to that idea. I do help other lawyers sue people. My background is actually in public health and law. And so what that means is I'm someone who really promotes public policy as a way to change the environment, to shape the environment in a way that's conducive to good health. But in that work, I found that really the obstruction is caused by industry. And so my work has really turned into researching and writing about corporate tactics to undermine public health. And, you know, I wish I could just stick to law, but really I can't, because as it turns out, you know, just advocating for good public policy isn't enough, because the industry really gets in the way. So I had this presentation I was planning to do, which I have done numerous times, kind of laying out the various food industry lobbying groups, explaining front groups, and then talking about various tactics that they engage in. But in the last few weeks, I've been very active in writing about Proposition 37 here in California. I'm just from Oakland across the bay. Thank you all for coming to my town. And I'm sorry if you're stuck here, but you know what? It could be worse to be stuck in San Francisco, right? So Proposition 37, if you're not familiar with it, is a simple measure, really, to require labeling of genetically engineered ingredients in food. And so I thought what I would do for you is kind of use that as a case study in corporate tactics, because really the corporate tactics that have been deployed in this campaign by the no side have been quite stunning. And so it just is a good illustration. And, you know, one of the, you know, ways that any campaign tries to get its word out is through mailers, right? And for a while I was seeing mailers from other people. I hadn't gotten mine yet, and I was really bummed. I thought, gee, are they skipping Oakland? Because, you know, we're all voting yes on 37 in Oakland. Or were they skipping me? Because they figured, right? Then I got mine. Last week I was very happy. So this is just an example. And what I really want to emphasize here is this. We're in a propaganda fight, right? I mean, everything you've heard so far is about industry trying to propagandize science. And so, you know, anything they put out is, I think that word propaganda has a negative connotation for a reason, but I really think it's what's going on. So this flyer says Prop 37 promoters have one thing on their mind, and it shows, you know, money. I mean, it's so juvenile, really. I mean, this is the best they can do. Ooh, they have money. Well, it doesn't even make sense. But then how do they prove that? So they had these scary pictures. Of course, what is one of the scary pictures of what kind of profession do we, I think, is so scary? Lawyers. So they find really bad pictures of people and put them on here. So this is Jim Wheaton, a man that's really been a hero in litigation for the public interest. But they say he's one of the lawyers that, you know, helped write this proposition. So it's written by a trial lawyer to benefit trial lawyers, because trial lawyers, if you don't know, are the particularly evil wing of the lawyer party. And so this is one of the biggest scare tactics they're using, right? That Prop 37 is going to result in all these shakedown lawsuits, because what other kind of lawsuits could there be than shakedown lawsuits? And then the other tactic in this particular flyer has to do with one of the major financial backers, Dr. McCullough. You know, we could debate whether his stuff is reliable or not. He's a very popular sort of alternative health practitioner, has a very popular website. happens to have a lot of money to donate to this campaign, right? He really believes in it. So this is just a typical tactic, right, to attack someone. But they're making these wild claims about how he and the natural food industry, which is also helping to fund the Yes campaign, has, you know, an economic stake in the outcome. I mean, you know, talk about pot calling the kettle black, right? I mean, there's really no limits to the hypocrisy of the argumentation coming out of this campaign. But so why is it important to understand the tactics? I want to just kind of paint the big picture first before I go into some of the details. It's really important to see the commonalities, right? We've already heard about the obstruction of science and intimidation tactics. But I'm going to walk you through some other tactics, and why it's important to think about them in this bigger picture way is that it's never about the specific issue that they're talking about, right? These tactics are common across all issues because they're so effective. And it's important to understand them so that we can call them out and say, well, wait a minute, when, you know, they talk about job loss, like in Richmond, California, like they're doing now on the soda tax issue there, that's a tactic that they've used for forever. Right, you name your government regulation, oh my God, you know, the economic sky is going to fall, we're going to lose, and of course now a very effective scare tactic. So when you put it in that context, you know, when you say, well, they always say there's job loss, it helps really kind of undercut the argument. So we hope. So one common tactic that I want to start with is understanding the concept of front groups, right? And a front group is basically a kind of pseudo-grassroots, it's sometimes called astroturfing, or it's a form of front group, I should say. The idea is to for industry to come together in a way that kind of hides who they really are. And my poster child for this type of group is the Center for Consumer Freedom, which has been around for a long time, and actually one of their main strategies I want to bring up is to attack the messenger. So I've been attacked by them, Mary Nessel, many in the food movement, and what you were talking about, this idea of attacking the scientist, it's a deflection strategy, right? We're not going to talk about, because the science is, you know, irrefutable, but if we attack the person behind the science, then that is a way to distract us and try to, you know, undermine his credibility. So this is a tactic that front groups engage in, and the idea is to shield the companies, because at least in the food industry, companies are very concerned about their reputations, right? So McDonald's, Kraft, they don't want to be out there doing the dirty tactics, so they create a front group that has a nice-sounding name, like, you know, Americans for Choice, or whatever the happy idea is. In Richmond, California, they named it, I think, like the Community for Beverage, against beverage taxes or something, you know, getting the word community in there when it's fully funded by Coke and Pepsi and the rest of the soft drink industry. So front groups are a really important tactic. And then the way it's worked out with the 37 campaign, they put the little guy, I mean, this is also just typical tactic, but they're using it with 37 this way. Put the small grocer out in front, the farmer, you know, the sympathetic business person who's going to be so overwhelmed by this regulation when, again, the true, you know, forces behind it in the case of 37, if you don't know who's funding the No campaign, it's Monsanto, DuPont, all the biotech and chemical companies, and the junk food industry. So speaking about science, what's been fascinating in watching the No campaign do its dirty work, they have engaged in this very common tactic of funding the science or hiring what is sometimes referred to as third-party experts. So the idea being that if you have an academic, you know, sort of bringing the message, then it looks like it's someone with good credentials, right? And in, on this issue, they have a deep well in UC Davis. So if you're not familiar with University of California at Davis, about an hour northeast of here, that is a land-grant university with huge money from the biotech industry. And there are a number of academics that that Monsanto et al. Has been putting up as the face of the No campaign. So they'll be writing op-eds, articles, reports. A couple of economics reports came out from UC Davis professors. And what's, you know, hilarious is they get to use their UC Davis affiliation, but then they'll have a disclaimer somewhere in there saying, well, this doesn't represent UC Davis. Like, you know, like the press release from Monsanto says, UC Davis report says this, and then, you know, somewhere in the world, it doesn't really represent UC Davis's position. But there it is. The point is, these are academics completely bought and sold by the biotech industry. They also used this expert named Henry Miller, a guy who used to be at FDA. He's just a big probiotic guy. He's got an MD, and he's at the Hoover Institution, but they have been promoting him by saying he's at Stanford. He's a professor at Stanford, which is really inaccurate, and actually Stanford University called them out on using this tactic, and they had to actually pull the TV ad they had where they showed him with the backdrop at Stanford and put his name, Henry Miller, Stanford, when really the Hoover Institution just happens to be housed on the Stanford campus, very different than being a professor at Stanford University. So they've used this tactic over and over, both in a TV ad and in their printed mailers. And then, of course, when they get called out on it, they say, oh, sorry, you know, we'll change it, as if it was like a mistake, and they just, you know, made a boo-boo. But, you know, you can't unring the bell. People have already seen the information. It's out there. They most recently, I just wrote an article about how they somehow they got this important scientific organization, AAAS, the American Academy, what is it, the Association for the Advancement of Science, some AAA thing, very important, what is it, the American Association of Advancement of Science. Thank you very much. So their motto is advancing science, serving people or something, and I said, are they advancing science or Monsanto? And because they came out with a statement just coincidentally last week, basically against GMO labeling, not naming Prop 37, but saying that there's no scientific basis for GMO labeling. And the statement read like a Monsanto press release. It's pretty stunning. And of course it got reported in the press. And of course, you know, anyone who might be, will be easily swayed by this type of organization. So that's another tactic, that they were able to maneuver this organization into timing that statement so strategically. And then, so first tactic was forming a front group, putting little guy up there. Second is hiring academics, putting third-party experts up there. And then third, I just like to call changing the topic, right? So, you know, they don't have the argument on their side, right? There's no good reason to not allow a simple label that says, right, why aren't they even marketing it, right? They're so proud of GMO technology. Okay, so they don't have a good reason to keep Californians in the dark about what they're eating. And so they changed the topic by putting these economics reports out there. Scare tactics are the name of the game here, right? Higher food prices. Food prices are already going up, obviously hard economic times. So this is what they're really hammering away. The economic study they did is completely bogus, paid for based on false assumptions, no scientific basis whatsoever, but does not matter. You just tell people, oh my God, your grocery bills are going to go up $400 a year. You win. And then the lawyer scare tactic I already talked about. And then the fourth category I just call lie, cheat, and steal. And they have engaged in a number of lies, a couple of ones I touched on, Henry Miller. But one of the most disgusting ones was in the California voter guide, right, that goes out to California voters and is, you know, the official statement of the yes and no side, et cetera. They listed a number of organizations that they said claimed that GMOs were safe. And I was at the meeting of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics when this organization put out a press release saying that they were falsely named in the voter guide as being one of these groups that said that GMOs were safe. And the Yes campaign hadn't even gotten wind of this. I was, you know, physically in Philadelphia while the group put this press release out, and I found out about it. I was like, oh my God. And this is in the official voter guide, and then the next day, you know, the Yes campaign put out a press release about it. And, of course, it's too late, right? You can't retract the voter guide and put the corrective tape in it. Everyone thinks that the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, the nation's leading nutrition trade professional group, represents registered dietitians, says GMOs are safe when they had put out a statement years ago. It was defunct. They were reviewing the science. They did not approve being in the California voter guide, and yet the No campaign put their name into that document. And then they misrepresented, by the way, the other groups that they listed in there. World Health Organization, AMA, had much more nuanced things to say than the way they were represented in the official California voter guide. So lies, twisting the truth, you know, deception. I always want to make sure people understand from a legal standpoint, deception can often be worse than lies, because deception means that you're leaving out information. So, for example, saying that the American Medical Association said that, you know, labels aren't necessary. But they also happen to say that they want to see pre-market safety testing done, which, by the way, the FDA does not require. You know, leaving out key information is a really typical tactic of industry, because it's not, it may not be a lie, like what they say is true, but leaving out information is deceptive and is illegal, by the way, in terms of advertising standards. Okay, so lastly, and then I'll wrap up and we'll get to discussion because I know we need to do that, but is just taking all these tactics, right, and then having millions of dollars, and the No campaign now is something like over $40 million of a war chest to bombard the public airways and engage in, you know, any number of public relations tactics to then get this disinformation, this propaganda into the public discourse and to brainwash people into their way of thinking. And it's been very effective because polling was very good for Prop 37 early on. Something like 66%, I think, of Californians said they were going to vote in favor of it. By the way, 90% of Americans nationwide are in favor of GMO labeling. But now the polls have they've been dropping every single week due to this bombardment of advertisement and disinformation and lies and, like, the California Board of Guide and mailers, et cetera. So it's extremely effective. And then other issues that are going on using these tactics, I mentioned California. There's two ballot measures on soda taxes. Same tactics are going on there, and often the same players. I mean, I think this is very interesting, too. I presented on Monday on junk food marketing to children, and a lead lobbying group there is a trade group called the Grocery Manufacturers Association. Well, they stated that they were making Prop 37 their number one priority. So, you know, we need to connect these dots, right? When we think of junk food companies, it's obvious that they're marketing to children, but they're also opposed to GMO labeling, right? Because soda and so many processed foods contains high fructose corn syrup. So, you know, it's important to call these companies and trade groups out. And then what to do about it? You know, we just need to be better prepared. Not just. We need to be better prepared. You know, I mean, advocates in public health, I'm sorry to say, are most, you know, they're very passionate. They're very good at fact sheets and data and science. And, you know, we're right because, you know, health is important. But that's not enough, right? Being passionate about, we know that we're right on the data, but we need to get political. I know you all know that because you're here. And I want to just leave you with a couple more examples of propaganda. So I mentioned this nutrition conference I was at. Coca-Cola is one of the biggest sponsors of that conference, and they had a bunch of materials. I just got to my favorite. Looking for answers for tough questions about beverages, health, and nutrition, where else would you turn to but Coca-Cola's Beverage Institute for Health and Wellness, and then a brochure on how sweet it is, the lowdown on low-calorie sweeteners, propaganda brought to you by Coca-Cola. And then for the first time, the candy lobby was there, and just in time for Halloween, they were giving out little packets of candy at the candy lobby booth and all about, you know, smart portion sizes. Where have you seen these tiny little, I mean, maybe at Halloween time, but, you know, you go to the movies, they're not selling you these little packets of candy, right? They're just giving you the gigantic ones. So anyway, that's what's going on with these groups, and happy to talk more about it either now or in Q&A, whether you want to do it. Thank you.
Just one or two questions. Great announcement. And a question for Michelle or comment?
I want to comment, if I can.
Okay.
Just on the general.
Oh, okay. Maybe we'll just go into the general stuff. That this is the opposite of what usually happens. Usually the last speaker gets all the questions because they just finished, right? Go ahead.
Thanks very much. Gabriel Scalise, my name. I'm from the UK, and I've been interested. I'm a trustee of the Soil Association in the UK. One of the things I found interesting in the title of this was the word fairness. And I would wonder, this is the same with the tobacco industry, are we right to be looking for fairness? You know, I'm just really pissed off with the way in which big business interrupts and disrupts and costs us all money and time, and just the amount of time that people have to put into answering questions and queries and so on. And surely we need to stop looking for fairness from these people and take the fight to them and disrupt them. For example, I've gone on a very short day. I live about half a mile from the global headquarters of Imperial Tobacco. And I think we should be stopping them building their building. We should be objecting to every planning permission they put in and doing everything we possibly can to obstruct and disrupt their businesses, so they're spending their time disrupting ours. So I'm not looking for fairness. We'd like to get even.
And a comment or question here?
I think it's kind of both a comment and a question. Jim Lloyd, with the Cook County Department of Public Health outside Chicago, Illinois. And I recently read a book, Weighing In, by, I believe, Julie Guffman. I hope I got her name right.
Yeah.
Very impressive book to me, very challenging. And she makes a number of critiques of the food movement and alternative food. And from someone who is really focusing on access to food and so-called food deserts, it really challenged me because I think it shows that really we're not going far enough. But I just want to ask your comments about her critique, because, for instance, she's saying that it's kind of a neoliberal approach to avoid a discussion of regulation, which is so clear about endocrine disruptors, and she specifically mentions that and ties it to obesity. In addition to, depending on market solutions, which she, I think, eloquently describes as part of the problem. So, how we can do a better job, not just looking at, there's so much emphasis going on soda taxes, and when nothing in local health departments that I'm aware of is talking about chemical fertilizers as much. I think that may be driven by CDC and others.
Okay, I'll make a quick comment if you want to respond to other environmental causes. So Julie Guthman's book, Weighing In, I also highly recommend, and she does a critique about actually the science around obesity and pointing and raises questions about other environmental factors other than the ones that we're looking at. But here's my rap about obesity. I have written about how we are spending way too much time, energy, and effort obsessing over obesity. There are some health impacts, but it's extremely problematic on so many levels. I also recommend another book by a colleague of mine named Linda Bacon called Health at Every Size, and she really debunks a lot of the obesity research. But I don't want to get into the scientific debate. For me, it's all about the politics. The food industry is happy to have a debate about obesity, right? Because this is a problem they can help fix. It's all about personal responsibility exercise. It's all about, we're going to reduce the calorie counts, and we're going to put calorie counts. McDonald's now has a huge campaign, calorie counts, right? I mean, look at all the ways industry is responding. It's really in large part because we, as a public health world, are framing the issue around obesity. And it's not getting to the heart of the matter, which is really corporate control of the food supply. And guess what? It doesn't matter, if you happen to be overweight or you're thin. If you're eating a poor diet, it's the same. Also, I just want to say stigma is an unbelievably huge problem. And we as public health professionals have to face the fact that we are perpetuating the hate mongering against fat people. And it needs to stop. Okay, thank you. I'm done.
So I just wanted to add in a comment. I also used to work at a health department, so I know some of the challenges there. There are a couple things, though. I mean, looking at the tobacco example and how tobacco moved, I mean, focusing on soda, focusing on something that's individual and proximal and that everybody can understand what a soda is, just like you can understand what a cigarette is, like that's a good place for action to start. And raising taxes, obviously, we know from tobacco decreases consumption. So it's not surprising that that's an area of emphasis, because trying to tackle something like atrazine is way more distal from people's daily experience, right? So it's harder to, just for people in the public health field even, to capsulize that. And sometimes that can also be really difficult. So, right, but I mean, as far as getting then increased movement around it, so for example, the tobacco industry, it took quite a while for tobacco control advocates to move from the individual to the environmental. So I think actually around food and agriculture, we're actually moving much more quickly than we do with tobacco, because we've learned from some of these other industries. But those can be some of the tensions as far as, how we can make something meaningful. Some of these more abstract ideas about things that are being spread all over fields, or if you're not near anything agricultural, that can be hard for you to really glom onto and get really activated about. So that's just a thought.
right here and then from here.
Thank you all. This is for all of you, but as a public health nurse who also does community organizing in Minnesota, so thank you. I'm wondering where you see not just ways, but places to leverage power and different power places, like if not in our academic institutions necessarily, and also already recognizing the community and community organizing, where else would you see hope for leveraging power to change the conversation away from maybe a topic as opposed to what the industries are actually doing, regardless in which industry or whatever?
Could probably talk loud enough, though.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Doesn't matter, is it? I mean, in my case, gosh, I wish I knew. I've been involved in trying a number of things. As you know, I've worked quite extensively with legislators in Minnesota. I worked behind the scenes with litigation. My least hope was actually with EPA. Just in the interactions that I had with EPA, and I think you're right. The problem with atrazine, which is where most of my experience is it's so complicated. You're talking about something that, even during a pregnancy, that may have an impact that you don't see, right? I mean, you smoke a cigarette, you get lung cancer, or you know, you're poisoned by something that's acutely poisonous. You immediately see what the problem is. For atrazine, it's, you know, even when you have the animal models and it. But I've tried also very much with sort of public education, and one of the things that I really hope that's happening is that more academics will become more involved. But there's actually a penalty. So you're actually viewed as no longer objective, or, you know, even in my evaluations when I come up for promotion, you know, they'll say, well, you're wasting your time with these public talks. They don't count. Or your publications that are going to the public, they don't really count. The things that we get, I'll tell a real quick story, the things that we get most credit for are things that don't matter to most people. So my most, in terms of my academic career, my most significant publications are with PNAS and Nature. And my favorite story is my mom calling up and saying, how important is that publication? Barnes and Noble never heard of that magazine. And, you know, sort of realizing that we reward people from actually isolating ourselves from the public and actually penalize. It's certainly in my career, maybe not in public health, maybe it's different, I don't know.
But
I think that's one of the main things that we have to do is actually break that barrier and really be involved in public education and not just the kind of ivory tower kind of stuff that we do.
Yeah, I would say I agree. And it's actually a very effective strategy to keep people who are funded by the public from taking responsibility in their careers for work to improve public health. And that makes us focus on ever more narrow issues. And, you know, you're not supposed to look at, I mean, your story couldn't possibly have happened for any other pesticides, right? It's just, atrazine is the only one, right? I mean, so, you know, but obviously the picture gets really big. So I'm going to ask, do any of the panelists or do any of you have any suggestions for how these issues apply to the American Public Health Association? That's something that David in particular asked us to address, and I see a hand in the back and then a hand here.
Yes, it does. The Bioinstitute is right here in our exhibitor hall. We have a resolution in the association years ago against the Bioinstitute. For those of you who remember what the first speaker said, the Bioinstitute is the one who denied angiosarcoma cases years ago. They are here collecting blood, doing a very beneficial action. And next to them, in front of them, is the American Chemistry
Council.
Yes. Chemistry Council. Used to be the Chemical Manufacturers Association.
Yep.
Those are the folks who brought you atrazine, formaldehyde, all the cancer we've been fighting for a long time. So I would like just to say something after I heard everything you said about atrazine. There was a book written in 1997 called Toxic Deception. One of the chemicals that was denounced at that time that was being paralyzed, paralysis by analysis, as we call it, was atrazine,
yep.
By EPA.
Yep.
15 years ago, at that time we already knew that atrazine was very bad. Now we have 100% of evidence, and still we are 15 years late and nothing much has been done.
Yep.
As far as regulation, as far as reducing, as far as finding alternatives, etc. And now, in our booth here, we have these chemical companies coming here to draw blood and send you nice stuff. So some of us confronted them and said, you should at least tell people the best side of your story. But the good side is, of course, chlorine has to be used for disinfection. This is what we said in our resolution in the 90s, when Greenpeace was actually showing how important chlorine was for chlorofluorocarbons, etc., for chemical, for climate change. All that is based on the production of this chemical. And we are here now having them inside of the light. I believe we should all write letters to EPA saying we should not accept these kind of institutions coming here, as we are not happy to fight.
All right.
Yeah, well, thank you for bringing that up, because I went to that booth, and it was hilarious. You know, oh, we're here with blood drives. Is that the only reason you're here? And then I gave them shit. But so I have to tell you, though, compared to the nutrition meeting I went to, like, night and day. I mean, really, APHA is pretty good in the expo hall. But to answer the original question, I think it is critical that we push APHA to get more political. They've done a good job, you know, with the healthcare bill and so forth, but they're not doing a good job in general going after corporations for causing so much of the public health harm that we are all here fighting against. And I can tell you, for one specific example, I have worked for several years in the alcohol policy field, and APHA will not take on alcohol. It's a devastating public health problem. It's one of the, you know, sort of silent public health killers. 80,000 people a year causes more economic harm, by the way, than even tobacco. But so, you know, why is that? Obviously, they're just not willing politically to take it on. And that, to me, is just heartbreaking. So, you know, that's just one example. What are they willing to do about the food industry? I'm not sure. I think they've done some good things with issues like CAFOs or the antibiotic issue. They'll kind of jump on to issues that other folks like David Wallinga has been organizing, but they definitely need to get more political. They have a booth out there on the policy. They call it Public Health Policy Arm, and I asked them what they were doing, and they said, well, I'm money from CDC, so we don't lobby. Okay, enough said.
Okay, there was one question right here, and I'm sorry this is going to have to be the last question, but everybody here, please keep this going. You know, take this back wherever you're going and join the food.
Well, my comment might be obvious, and that is that I do think all of us need to become more politically active, not necessarily just by speaking what we feel. We need to run for office. And we need to find others to run for office. We need to not run for office.
All right. You got my vote. All right. And so I want to ask you to thank all the speakers. And let's keep the issues in front of APHA.